Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Mary Cranston, Chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and it is my pleasure to welcome today Speaker Madeleine Albright, former U.S. Secretary of State and currently Chair and Principal of Albright Capital Management and author of Memo to the President-Elect. Secretary Albright is one of the most exceptional and inspirational leaders of our time, and we are very honored to have her with us today. She was sworn in as the 64th Secretary of State of the United States on January 23, 1997, the first woman to hold that office. She served with distinction, reinforcing America's alliances, advocating human rights around the globe, and advocating the American trade, business, and environmental standards of our country. Prior to her service as Secretary of State, she served for 4 years as the United States permanent representative to the United Nations and as a member of President Clinton's cabinet and his National Security Council. As a research professor of international affairs and director of the Women in Foreign Service program at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service, she taught courses in international affairs, U.S. foreign policy, Russian foreign policy, and Central and Eastern European politics. She was responsible for developing and implementing some truly groundbreaking programs to enhance women's professional opportunities in international affairs, and on behalf of the American women, I want to thank you for that. Her new book, Memo to the President-Elect, draws on her many years of experience to present a tour de force assessment of what needs to be done to rehabilitate America's security, image, and influence abroad, and how to go about it. And nothing could be more timely. We're very fortunate to have her today. I could spend actually the full hour going over Secretary Albright's honors that are numerous and well-deserved and the highlights of her many other accomplishments, but I know we would all rather hear directly from the wise and wonderful Madeleine Albright on the critical subject of America's future. Secretary Albright.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mary. Thank you all very much. Thank you. Thank you so much for that very full introduction, because not everybody knows who I am. I recently was in China, and I was coming back, and Chicago was the first port of entry. And as I was there getting undressed for the security people, I put down my stuff on the conveyor belt. And the lady ahead of me said, "So where'd you get all those screw top bottles? Mine all leak." And I said, "Well, I got them at the container store." And then I'm going through the magnetometer, and the TSA guard looks at me and says, "Oh, my God, it's you." And he said, "I'm from Bosnia, and we all love you in Bosnia, and the people of Bosnia thank you so much, and there wouldn't be a Bosnia without you, and I have to have my picture taken with you." So he stops the whole line. We have our picture taken. And then I go back to get my stuff, and the lady of the screw top bottle says, "So what exactly happened here?" And I said, "Well, you know, I used to be Secretary of State." And she said, "Of Bosnia?" So thank you very much. I am indeed very pleased to be here and to have a chance to talk to the members of the Commonwealth Club again. It's a great group. Love San Francisco. My daughter, son-in-law, and grandchildren live here, so I'm always delighted to come back. So anytime you want to invite me, I'm happy to be here. I wanted to talk to you today about my book, and I wrote it. It's a little bit of a contrivance to say that it's a memo to the President-elect. It is written to be read election night, and it's kind of fun to say you need to do this and you need to do that. But it's basically for you, for the American readers, because it's out now and is really there, I hope, as a way of creating some kind of a framework for the national security issues that are going to be discussed during this year. I do indeed teach a course at Georgetown at the moment, and I say foreign policy is just trying to get some other country to do what you want. That's all it is. So what are the tools? My course is called the National Security Toolbox, and we examine the tools, and some of that is in this book. I decided that I wanted to write this book while I was at Gerald Ford's funeral ceremony at the Washington National Cathedral. And it was really, obviously, a remarkable event, and all the former presidents were there, and the current president was there. And it made me really think about the presidency itself and the challenges of the presidency, the difficulties, the opportunities, what are the limits on the president's power. And so I thought I would write a book that put together my thoughts on the presidency, having, as Mary said, I served for both President Carter and President Clinton, and had seen, in fact, how presidencies function, and then also experiences of my own and this course. Now, the first part of the book really is the how-to part of it, and I had great time doing research to see what other presidents had done in creating their presidency, but I got a big kick out of Warren Harding, not one of our best, who said, "I wish there were a book that would tell me what to do." So here it is. A little late for him, but that's what it is. It's interesting to think about what needs to happen when you first arrive and how you put together a team. And I advocate very strongly that the team be one in which there are a lot of different views. And for that, I really take my model from Abraham Lincoln, who, as you all know, according to Doris Kearns' book, put together a team of rivals. So I put a great deal of emphasis on the fact that a president needs to listen to a lot of different people. But I also underline the word team, because I know this doesn't happen in friendly San Francisco, but in Washington, people try to prove how smart they are by making the person sitting next to them look stupid. So the bottom line is to have people with different views, but also who respect each other in a team effort. I talk some about how the national security system works, the decision-making process, why it is, in fact, that the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense automatically dislike each other until they unite in disliking the National Security Advisor, and all the complexities of that and how to get a team on the ground quickly, how to set priorities, and what some of the historical precedents of that has been. I have thought a lot about what leadership is about and what kind of things I'd like to see in the next president. So that's the first part of the book. The second part of the book actually deals with the issues. And I believe that in looking at the issues, that this is going to be, in national security policy, a very, very difficult presidency. Frankly, I've spent my whole life in foreign policy in some form or another, and I don't think I've ever seen the world in such a mess. That's a diplomatic term. There are so many different issues out there that have either been exacerbated or neglected that are going to have to be dealt with by the next president. And so let me just give a few of them, and then I hope in the questions, the ones that really interest you, we can examine more closely. There really are five overriding umbrella kind of issues that are very much present in the second decade of the 21st century. They are, first, terrorism. We do have to fight terrorists. Terrorists want to kill us, we have to kill them. But it has to be done in a way that doesn't create more terrorists and more anti-Americanism. And that's what's been happening, is that, in fact, we are creating many more terrorists. We're not real good about a word like the war on terror. We're not good at fighting nouns. And I think that what we need to do is to think through what it means when you say it's a war on terror. What we've done is basically create among al-Qaeda warriors. They then enhance their own mythical stature when, in fact, they have no program at all. I mean, there is no economic program of al-Qaeda or anything that is attractive as an ideology, and the only thing they have in the end is a posthumous recognition on their website for somebody that is a suicide bomber. So I think we have to fight the terrorists, but as I say, not in a way to create anti-Americanism. The second big issue has to do with the fact that there is a proliferation of nuclear weapons and nuclear technology, and the system which has governed our lives for many decades now is broken, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which was set up on a deal that the nuclear powers, of which there were five, would systematically disarm and that new powers would not seek to develop nuclear weapons. And on both sides of that bargain, it has been broken. There are new nuclear powers with India and Pakistan and North Korea. And the United States, instead of disarming, is in fact has been talking about a new generation of nuclear weapons. So that needs to be rethought. A great deal of effort has to be put into a new regime, and with the ultimate goal that we can't let the worst weapons get into the hands of the worst people. The third big issue out there is the fact that democracy has lost its good name. I believe in democracy. I think that we're all the same, and we're better off, and the countries, people in countries throughout the world are better off if they are able to choose their own governments. And so I think democracy is key. But what has happened to democracy within this administration has really hurt, because all of a sudden, instead of being identified with the choice of the people, which is to support democracy, the United States in supporting democracy, we have been imposing democracy, which is an oxymoron. And so democracy has become identified with military force. President Bush has spoken at length about the need to promote democracy in the Middle East, and that was one of the reasons for the war in Iraq. But the bottom line is, there are not a lot of leaders in the world that look at Iraq and say, I want my country to look just like that. So it has not helped democracy. The fourth big issue has to do with globalization. I am in business now, and people come and they say, well, what do we do to stop globalization? Well, you can't stop globalization. It has many positive aspects, but it does have some negative aspects. And I think we need to look at how to mitigate the negative aspects. And the one that concerns me a great deal at this moment is what has happened in terms of enlarging the gap between the rich and the poor. If we were all rich, it would be very nice. If we were all poor, it would be too bad. But at least we'd all be the same. But what has happened now is that the poor know what the rich have as a result of very widespread information technology. And so while there is absolutely no direct line between poverty and terrorism, when huge numbers of people are either disenfranchised or are marginalized by society or are thought not to be able to be a part of an economic system, they do in fact provide a very happy kind of environment for those who want to recruit people that are dissatisfied and hate us. And the fifth big issue, finally, is the whole bundle of issues to do with global warming, climate change, and energy. So those five big issues will be overriding for the next president of the United States. Now, within or under those umbrella issues, we have the following immediate issues. There are two hot wars going on now, Afghanistan and Iraq, and their unintended consequences. There are a lot of people, when they talk about diplomacy or international relations, say it's like a game of chess. It's not like a game of chess. Chess is where two people sit quietly, map out their moves, have plenty of time between their moves. I think it's more like billiards or pool, where there are a bunch of balls in the middle of the table. You come, you bring, get the cue stick, you strike a ball, you hope it'll get to where you want it to go. But on the way, it hits a lot of other balls. It's very horizontal and dynamic, and unintended consequences. Though I have a student who's Chinese who is absolutely convinced that it's all predictable, the way the billiard balls go. Not in the way that I've seen it play. So Afghanistan, where I believe that President Bush did absolutely the right thing in retaliating against those who had planned to attack, who did attack us. He took his eye off the ball in order to have some kind of artificial linkage between Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, and Saddam Hussein. And in the meantime, the issues in Afghanistan got worse. And every day in reading the papers, you can see that that war is going badly. We are having to send more Marines there. We have created animosity among the people, and the Taliban is resurging and, in fact, financing a lot of their arms purchases and the fighters with an increased poppy crop, which in itself is a threat because that's how opium is produced. So Afghanistan itself is going badly, but the biggest unintended consequence of Afghanistan is Pakistan. Pakistan contains every element of what gives policymakers an international migraine. It has nuclear weapons, extremism, poverty, corruption, and now a completely unstable government. And so what is happening in Pakistan is very worrisome and obviously will be something that the next president has to deal with because in its location and relationship, we need Pakistan. So that is that hot war. The second hot war is obviously Iraq. In my previous book, you know, when you write a book, you hope very much that what you predict is true, comes true. I really am sorry that this has. I have said that I'm afraid that Iraq will go down in history as the greatest disaster in American foreign policy, which means that I think it's worse than Vietnam, not in terms of the number of Americans who've died, or number of Vietnamese versus Iraqis, but in terms of those unintended consequences. Secretary Powell, I think, had a very telling statement when he said that Iraq, you had to apply the pottery barn rule, which is you broke it, you own it. There are real questions as to what our responsibilities are for Iraq now. First of all, our military have behaved brilliantly, and from a military perspective, it's hard to argue that the surge isn't working. But from a political perspective, which theoretically was the reason for the surge in the first place, to get some kind of a political settlement, that's not going very far. I believe that it would be a mistake to partition Iraq. The billiard ball effect would really happen there in terms of the relationship with Turkey and then with Iran and then the center part of the Sunnis, which is not a cohesive part anyway. But something has to be done in order to give greater autonomy to the various parts of Iraq and help in terms of developing some kind of a political settlement. I was stunned last week when I read that the Iraqi defense minister said that our forces had to stay until 2018 because he was concerned about the borders of Iraq, the fact that they were porous and that arms and terrorists were crossing, which means that what is required is a surge in diplomacy, some kind of a regional aspect of trying to get the neighbors to protect those borders and to make sure that the chaos there is not enlarged. There are now about 5 million people that are displaced as a result of the war, 2.5 million refugees in the neighboring countries, and about 2.5 million of displaced people within Iraq itself. And I think the biggest unintended consequence of Iraq is the fact that Iran is the country that has gained the most out of it. I think you could really make that argument. And all of a sudden, Iran is a major power in the region and threatening to us. We are, I think all of us at this stage, are confused about what they are or are not doing in their nuclear program. But they clearly make ridiculous statements about Israel and are flexing their muscles. And they are Persians. They are the Persian Empire, which is very different from Arabs and the issues in the region. I think that what has to happen is that we need other countries to help us in Iraq, which I think is going to require a great deal of diplomacy. And the combination of those two hot wars, which we cannot deal with all by ourselves, and those five big issues, really, I think, are self-evidently show that the style of American leadership has to change, that we are going to need to have partners, alliances that work, some sense that the United Nations can help on a lot of these issues, some regional organizations, but there has to be a different approach. I had said over and over again that the United States was an indispensable nation. Indispensable, no part of that definition says alone. It just means that we have to be active and engaged, and I think the U.S. is going to have to work hard to get the neighboring countries involved in both these resolution of these wars and then generally in terms of the five big issues. And that means that we have to refurbish our relationship with the Europeans. It would help a lot if the Europeans stopped examining themselves and thought more about how we could have a common agenda on a whole host of issues. We need to have a very different approach with Russia. Russia is moving from some attempts at democracy to autocracy. They are very rich now and are beginning to look at, not beginning, but are in fact figuring out how to control their former Soviet states and the neighbors through oil targeting by turning the spigot off and on and buying up energy companies and pipelines and also threatening Western Europe this particular way. But we need Russia. We need it to cooperate on certain issues to do with Iran, because they're one of the permanent members of the Security Council, on dealing with North Korea and to keep their nose out of what's happening in Kosovo, which is why I think we have to be very careful to pick our agenda items with Russia. Why this administration started talking about putting various parts of anti-missile defense into the Czech Republic and Poland when they don't even work, and really putting a much heavy duty on our problems with Russia, and now being in a position where, because Putin is threatening, we can't really back off. So we have to choose our agenda items with the Russians very carefully. China. Every time anybody talks about China, they put the adjective rising with it. The Chinese are developing a military reach, and they are investing in Africa. But we have a very integral relationship with China. They are owning more and more of us, and they need us for their markets. And so we have to develop a functioning relationship with them as well as India. And in addition to that, I haven't even mentioned what has been the result not only of a unilateral foreign policy, but a unidimensional one, which is that the administration has paid very little attention to Africa and Latin America. And both those very large areas of continents need to be part of the dealings of foreign policy, national security policy for the next president. So that is just the beginning of the agenda. It will, as I say, be a very difficult presidency. And I think that we need to talk about these issues, and we need to discuss where we want to be engaged and where we do not. I want to see in the next president somebody who is confident but not certain, because as a human being, absolute certainty is impossible. Confidence allows a leader to listen to those diverse ideas in the cabinet and throughout the country, to be curious, to ask a lot of questions, to push, to argue, to respect those who disagree. A certain president does not even know what he doesn't know. So the bottom line is that what we need to do is to look for leaders who listen, who will have the respect of other leaders, and who also can put themselves into the shoes of other countries in order to get the best for America. And so I do think this is a totally and clearly important election, and I hope that my book really helps in the discussion. Thank you all so much, and I now look forward to answering your questions. Great. I must say the best part about no longer being Secretary of State is I'm going to be able to answer your questions.
Oh, good. Well, we certainly have a lot of them, and our thanks to Madeleine Albright for her comments today. Let me begin with the questions. I received a number of questions about some of the political arenas in the world today, and you're one of the most knowledgeable people about these, and we would like to know what you think about Palestine, Israel, and Gaza, and what the next president ought to do in that area.
Obviously, one of the issues that will be front and center for the next president is on the Middle East peace process, and as I talked about the hot wars in the Middle East, part of what has happened here is that there was less attention paid to that because President Bush thought that the road to Jerusalem was through Baghdad. And there was not a lot of attention paid. And while, in fact, there was a roadmap. It has never been taken out of the glove compartment. So it isn't until recently that President Bush decided that he wanted to pay attention to the area. Secretary Rice has gone there a number of times. I was in Israel, actually, in December, right after the Annapolis conference. And I think they were very encouraged there. I met with Prime Minister Olmert and also with Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinians, and they were very encouraged by it and very glad that the United States was now involved. And I think I'm very pleased that that's happened. The question is, what will the next steps be? I think it is generally agreed that both Prime Minister Olmert and Mahmoud Abbas are not in a particularly strong position with their own people. And it's possible that two leaders that are not that strong could actually find in common that they could help each other. So that is the positive aspect of this. The problem is that it is easy enough to make grand statements, but ultimately there have to be some working groups. And the question is whether how they're going to put these working groups together. And I can tell you from my past experience that even the names of the working groups pose a problem. If you call it refugees, that's one thing. If you call it the right of return committee, it is something else. So you have to be very careful in terms of picking the names. So somebody said, well, let's just give them numbers. But, you know, then if you're one or six, that makes a difference. So it's the details of that kind that are a problem. And most recently, there is the issue of Gaza. Because Hamas really is a terrorist organization, I'm the one that put them on the terrorist group list, and I wish that we had not pressed for elections there unless there had been an entry fee. The entry fee being that if you're going to run in a democratic election, you should give up in your charter that you're going to use violence. And so it is very hard to deal with Hamas. But the isolation of Gaza and the fact that out of Gaza, Hamas is shooting rockets into Israel has created an additional set of issues. And as you probably all know, Palestinians have destroyed a portion of the wall between them and Egypt and are pouring in there in order to get fuel and food because the Israelis had cut off contact. So that has created a huge problem. And I hope that the president is paying a lot of attention to this. And my fondest hope is that there will be an agreement by the end of the year and that the next president of the United States will be able to implement that agreement. But if there isn't that miracle, I think that what the United States has to do, the next president, is be deeply engaged in the Middle East process again, appoint a special envoy, a peace team, and spend a lot of time on it, because I do not think this is central to all the problems that ever are in the world, which is a tendency that people say, but it is an issue that needs to be solved for its own sake.
So this is a somewhat related question, particularly in light of your answer, but what would you say is the proper way for the United States to deal with religious extremism around the globe and its implications for policy?
You didn't know you were advertising my last book. I wrote a book called The Mighty and the Almighty, which is about the role of God and religion in foreign policy. And I am one of those people of an age that, in fact, used to say, X problem is complicated enough, let's not bring God and religion into it. And then when, during the first term of the Clinton administration, we had the issue of Northern Ireland, and it was really hard for me to believe that Protestants and Catholics were killing each other for the sake of religion, wrapped up in nationalism at the end of the 20th century. And then on the issue of the Middle East, you know, if Jerusalem was just a real estate issue, we would have solved it a long time ago. But because both or all the parties involved believe that that little piece of land was given to them by God, there actually is another presence in the room. We tried to figure out at Camp David how to begin to talk about divine sovereignty, that maybe the holy places belong to God, and then they could be administered some other way. But I think that it is very important to understand the religious basis of what is going on in a number of countries. It would help if people had known the difference between Sunni and Shia. If we had any real understanding of Islam, I have been in this book, the last book that I did, I think that I tried to explain the basic principles of Islam. I think we don't even know how to talk about it. I am in a number of discussion groups, and people don't even know the politically correct language to use. It's incorrect to talk about the Muslim world. I mean, it's not monolithic. A lot of people think that most Muslims live in the Middle East. They don't. They live in Indonesia. And after that, the largest number lives in India, more than are in Pakistan. So there are all kinds of things that we need to learn. And I think that one of the ways to get at this problem of extremism is, and even the vocabulary on this is bad, moderate Muslims, because moderate Muslims don't believe moderately, that they could help in terms of the interpretation so that Islam is not identified with extremism. And each one of the monotheistic religions have extremes in them, I think. And Christianity isn't monolithic, and neither is Judaism. So I think we need a much deeper understanding of the issue, because you can't start talking about Islamofascists or, say, Islamic terrorists, because terrorism is not an Islamic concept.
Thank you, Secretary Albright, for that illuminating answer. We are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. You were our representative to the UN for many years, and I have a number of questions about the future of the UN, its relevancy, what kind of a leadership role it might take in today's world, and how we're going to fund it going forward.
A most appropriate question in San Francisco, and I do think that we have all, over history, taken pride in being the founding members of the UN and having it happen here in San Francisco, and the hope that both President Roosevelt and President Truman had for the United Nations. The UN basically was paralyzed by the Cold War, and what was terrific about when I was there from 1993 to 1997 was that the UN was coming alive, and we were looking at how it could be used in a variety of different ways, to go back to my toolbox in multilateral diplomacy, of ways that action could be taken by the UN that we could not or did not want to do alone, or how to really enhance the peacekeeping mechanism so that as a lot of the ethnic conflicts came to the fore, that the peacekeepers, international peacekeepers, could help. It clearly was a difficult period because this was trying to develop how this tool worked, how the whole multilateral sanctions worked, and it was made more difficult by the fact that we actually owed the United Nations money and were creating artificial financial crises at the same time as we were trying to get the UN to reform. So what would happen is I would say, we need to change this system, and they'd say, where's your money? And it actually led our best friends, the British, to say in a General Assembly session, a line they'd been waiting over 200 years to say, which was representation without taxation. And I do think that the UN does need reforming, but it is a very, very useful institution. The problem is, as many of you know, there are Americans who are terrified of the UN. They think it has black helicopters that swoop down in the middle of the night and steal your lawn furniture. And then there are people who don't like the UN because it's full of foreigners, which frankly can't be helped. So but it needs reforming.
Thank you. Secretary Albright, you have an exceptional record on human rights, and you mentioned earlier that China is an important partner of the United States for many reasons, not least of which the economic power of that bloc. But what would you say about human rights issues in China and other parts of the world and their implications for American policy going forward?
One of the things that I have political science background, both as a student and a professor, and one of the big discussions, and as a practitioner also, is that the difference between idealism and realism. And I don't like that artificial distinction and a false dichotomy, because I think what needs to happen is I don't know what I am, an idealist or a realist, so I call myself an idealistic realist or a realistic idealist. So I believe that human rights is a very important aspect of American foreign policy. It's what we base our own value system on, and we need to raise it at all times. But there are also, as with China, whenever anything's really complicated, you say it's a multifaceted relationship. So we have a multifaceted relationship with China. We need to deal with the Chinese on a whole host of issues, but I think we also have to talk about human rights. The problem that's happened is that while I believe the United States is an exceptional country, we have asked that exceptions be made for us. And when we were in office, we would regularly take countries to the Human Rights Commission to complain about their human rights records. We are now laughed out of court because of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo.
Fair point. One of our audience was asking a question about the centralization of political power in many countries. It seems to be a trend going on right now, looking at Putin in Russia, Sarkozy in France, Bush in the United States. And I wondered what you thought about the assumption by the highest political officers of additional investigatory and political power at times of terrorism and global uncertainty.
Well, I think that there's a dual problem here. As I said earlier, there are terrorists. Nobody made that up. There really are, and they did attack the United States, and there are other places where terrorism has killed people and created havoc, and clearly one of the responsibilities of a state is to protect its people. The question is, what are the mechanisms that are used, and at what stage do you so protect the people that you undermine the very society that you are trying to protect? I honestly have no problems in getting undressed at the airport. That is an irritation. But having my civil liberties taken away is very serious. And so I am worried about some of the steps that have been taken in the name of protecting us from terrorists that, in fact, have given us a bad name and the things that we've talked about. The other part that makes me very nervous is that other countries have taken the fear of terrorism to the extent that they are then limiting freedom within their own country. So you take, for instance, now they had some explosions in Moscow, but what President Putin did was to take that in order to restart the war in Chechnya and make clear that everybody that wanted anything in Chechnya was a terrorist. And so it is a very blunt instrument and has to be watched very carefully. I hope that our next president understands that a lot of the executive orders that have been put into place now need to be overturned, that we can't use the fear factor to run this country, and that our anxiety should actually come from undermining the Constitution. And I think that this is going to be a very big issue. But I think we have to be honest enough with ourselves to know that there are terrible people out there and that there is a way through cooperation on intelligence issues and still with the rule of law to try to figure out how to capture those who are trying to kill us.
In a nutshell, based on what you've just said, what do you think would be the best way for the president-elect of the United States to reestablish our position as a moral force in the world and someone to listen to on how to deal with terrorism and political rights?
Well, I think the next president is going to have a huge opportunity to change our image. And I think there will be a short honeymoon. But I underline the short because there really has been a whole question about how the United States behaves and how we act in the world generally. And I think that there will have to be a very clear denunciation of the kinds of things that have happened thus far. I think Guantanamo has to be closed. That will be a big step forward. I think whether the next president actually automatically takes away these executive orders will be something that is looked at. And generally, how we decide to comport ourselves in terms of an international norms. The thing that I have said a lot is for many of us, and as I look out in the audience, some of you are my age, I think that for me, I wasn't born in the United States and came here when I was 11, and for me, America was defined by Omaha Beach or the Marshall Plan or the Alliance for Progress or various ways that we were using the goodness of American power. And now, with most of the world under 30, if you say the United States, they mostly think of torture. And I'm not making this up. The Pew Attitude surveys have shown a declining image of the United States. So just code words of Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo have hurt. And I think making clear that that is not going to be the policy of the next president will go a long way, but it's not going to be easy just to all of a sudden have us be back where we were in terms of being viewed as an exceptional country.
I'm glad you mentioned the next generation, and certainly you have children and grandchildren. There were several questions from our young members in the audience about how they can be effective over the next 5 years in helping the United States internationally with its image.
I think that, there's a lot has been made of this concept of public diplomacy. And there are various parts that people think are public diplomacy. Some people think it's just propaganda. It is not. Propaganda is just pushing out a message one way. Public diplomacy involves the art of listening and exchange. And I think the young people that I have in my classes or ones that I know are my own children, I think have a much greater sense about participating internationally. I'm fascinated by the number of people that are either involved in international business or non-governmental organizations or interested in being exchange students. And I really think that our young people are our best ambassadors, that there need to be, we need to put money into exchange scholar programs, visitor programs. The Peace Corps is fantastic. Continues to be one of the best ways to show America. And then people, in these Pew surveys, it shows people actually like Americans. They like us somewhat less than they did between 2000 and 2004 because they don't know how we could have reelected George Bush. But still, they love American music. They like American young people and blue jeans and everything. And so I think we need to get our young people out there. The other that I find with the ones that I know, I think there is a much greater activism. For instance, the Save Darfur movement was really started at the universities, and that kind of public consciousness and social responsibility aspects in the young people, a little better than the students I taught in the 80s who were worried about their retirement plans. So I think that there is the sense of duty and a desire to participate in some kind of civic work.
Circling back to Iraq, there are, as you can imagine, many questions in this pile on that subject, and you've touched on it. What clear advice would you have on the most prudent and quickest way out of Iraq for this country?
Well, again, I am an optimist. I do worry a lot. I wish I could give a totally optimistic answer. There are no good options on Iraq. That is the problem. It was a war of choice, not of necessity, and it is carrying with it all these different unintended consequences. I do think we have to get out because our troops, as magnificent as they are a paradox in many ways because they are part of the solution in terms of providing security, but they're also part of the problem because they're like flypaper that attract everybody who hates us. And so they have to figure out, we have to figure out how to get them out in a way that does not create a total vacuum. And so the next president is going to have to, I believe, depending upon who's elected, get the people out in a systematic way. But nothing is simple because I now know that forces need to protect forces as they get out, and forces are needed to protect the diplomats so they can't all be pulled out. And then we can't leave the equipment there. We cannot leave it because we don't know whose hands it would fall into. But I've been reading some interesting articles which indicate that the armored personnel carriers and the trucks and all those things that have been riding around the sand are filled with all kinds of bugs that are native to that part of the world, not to us. And so before we bring them home here, they all have to be cleaned. But there's not a lot of water there. So the question is, how is that all going to be done? And I also, in light of the cooperation that is necessary, I always say The U.S. didn't start World War I or World War II. But when we saw that it affected our national interest, we went in there and turned it around. And while there are countries that disagree with how this war started, I think it is in their national interest to help in ending it and getting the troops out. And so they need to help in the training of the Iraqis. They have to be a part of the reconstruction. They need to help with these refugees. And that is going to also require that different style of work of all working together. But there are no easy options, and I don't think we can just walk out. I am asked, if I may say so, by the most liberal audiences, what are our responsibilities to the Iraqis? I mean, they're very glad that Saddam Hussein is gone, but the chaos there is something that we do need to take some responsibility for.
What do you think the president-elect is going to have to do to recruit other countries to help in Iraq?
Well, first of all, I think that there has to, as I said earlier, be a different approach in terms of consultation and diplomacy. And in order to get our national interest fulfilled, we need to understand what some of their desires and national interests are. And it's not going to be easy, because many of them basically feel that we screwed this up. But I do think that there are trade-offs on things. One of the reasons that President Bush has had such a hard time internationally is that the first thing he did was walk out of Kyoto, an international agreement that was to benefit other people. I think if the next president off the bat said, we are going to have a new conference on what to do about climate change, where we will talk with all of you and respect you, it will resound somewhere else. The positive aspects of a billiard ball effect.
We did have a number of questions about global warming. You mentioned it briefly as one of the big issues. What would be your prescription for the president-elect in dealing with the global climate problems?
Well, this first thing, I think, of really sitting down and not doing a performance like Kyoto or even Bali, where we also were telling everybody what to do. But understand, it's a complicated problem. There really is the difference between the level of pollution of industrialized countries and those who want to become industrialized. And they kind of, I mean, the Chinese basically say to us, you got to pollute all this time to get industrialized. Why are you stopping us? And so there has to be, first of all, an understanding of that we're all in this together, but also a persuasion that there is money to be made in the development of new environmentally appropriate technology. I have to say, you all may be surprised, but I get myself all exercised about things by listening to Rush Limbaugh. And I do it as I drive to work. It's kind of amazing that I haven't had a terrible accident. But what I found so interesting was listening to him when there was somebody who called in and said there was money to be made in environmentally appropriate technology, but that they didn't believe in global warming. So they were trying to figure out how to say it's fine to make money off of this thing that they didn't believe in. But there truly is a way to give incentives on that basis. And to work out agreements between the developing countries and us. But it's going to take a lot of work. And looking at carbon trading systems and looking at alternative sources of fuel and trying to figure out the unintended consequences of going into one form versus another. And there's going to be an incredible amount of work to be done, but again, not by the U.S. alone. And there has to be some sense of humility that we have contributed to all of this.
Thank you, Secretary Allwright. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. You were just talking about worldwide investment in global warming, and I wondered if you could expand that just a little bit and talk about where you see the global economy going. It looks like we're heading into a worldwide recession, undoubtedly stimulated by the globalization and the interconnection of all the economies. What do you think that will do to protectionary movements, and what would you recommend that the United States do to try to help the world at this time?
Well, I do think it's very clear how integrated the world economy is. And there are not a lot of people that used to understand that if you wake up in the morning and you listen to the market reports from Japan, that it will affect where we're going all day long, or commodity prices in one area versus another, or the integration now increasingly of various stock markets. So we are truly integrated, and obviously what's happened in the United States with the prime, the mortgage rates and everything has had a huge effect internationally and the weakness of the dollar. I think that this goes back to one of my points about globalization. It has positive aspects and negative aspects. I personally do believe that trade has to exist and there has to be free and fair. But I do also think that it is important to look at some of these agreements that have been negotiated to see whether the labor and environmental standards are being fulfilled. But jobs at lower rates are something that do affect the American economy. Our labor movement is not very happy. Hearing a couple of days ago where Ford and GM are laying off workers is something that generally affects. So there have to be some policies, I am not an economist, but that really do take into consideration the difficulties here and understand the integration into the rest of the world. What I do think is a new phenomenon that we have to figure out how to deal with are these sovereign funds, where countries that, for either because of the size of their economies or because they have oil, all of a sudden have huge amounts of money that they are prepared to invest in us. I mean, we in some ways are acting like a developing country. And the question is how we regulate and monitor that so that if the sovereign funds are controlled by the governments of those countries, that they don't decide all of a sudden to go into certain strategic industries and then, for whatever reason, decide to pull out at a particular moment. So I think these are all the issues that are out there that need to be looked at. But I would think, and this is my personal view, that it would be a real disaster if the United States either because we feel threatened by globalization or we're mad at people for not liking us, or the Iraqi war has so exhausted our military that we would decide to turn inward. This is not the 1920s or 30s where we can all of a sudden decide not to have anything to do with the world. And so the next president has to make clear and educate about the need for American engagement and participation in a global economy.
We have a question here about your assessment of the performance of Condoleezza Rice. And as someone who's walked in those same shoes as the Secretary of State, what would be your assessment?
Well, I have decided not to comment on current Secretaries of State, but I do have to tell you about my relationship with her because I think this might surprise some people. My father was a Czechoslovak immigrant professor, an ambassador, who, when we came to the United States, went to teach at the University of Denver. And in 1977, by then he was dean of the Graduate School of International Studies and a real personality in Denver when he died. And so there were tons of flowers and things. And among the various things there was a ceramic container in the shape of a piano with lots of leaves and things. And I said to my mother, "Where did this come from?" And she said, "It's from your father's favorite student, Condoleezza Rice." She had gone to the University of Denver as a music major, hence the piano, had taken a course in international relations with my father, and he persuaded her to become an international relations major. She then went to Notre Dame to get her master's and then was back working on her PhD with my father when he died. So in 1987, when I was helping Michael Dukakis, and my job was to find foreign policy advisors, informal, so I thought, I'll call her up. Here she was, a woman, African-American, Soviet expert, teaching on the West Coast, perfect. So I called her and I explained to her what I was doing and could she be an advisor to Michael Dukakis, and she said, "Madeline, I don't know how to tell you this, but I'm a Republican." And I said, "Condi, how could you be? We had the same father." So we clearly learned different things from him, which I think is evident now.
Thank you. I think that story truly demonstrates what a small world we have. Thank you for that. We've also had some questions about your assessment of Bush. You've shared some of your thoughts. One of my favorite questions is, what should be the title of Bush's memoirs?
a good question. I have to tell you something. This book is critical of President Bush, and I've made no bones about it. I think that this has not been a great presidency. And what's very interesting is how I have been attacked for criticizing the president, and in fact accused of not being very patriotic by daring to criticize the president, especially in a time of war. And I consider that insulting to all of us, frankly, because I think it's actually a patriotic duty to ask questions. And that is what we should all be doing. So I have to think about the exercise, exercise, exercise might be the title of his.
Well, I'm sure it's not going to surprise you, but we've received many questions about the current political campaign and your views on the candidates. Obviously, you're a supporter of Hillary Clinton, but you're also very well placed to assess the statements and the policy proposals being put forth by all of the candidates. Would you be willing to share your views on the front-running candidates?
But no, actually. I mean, let me say this. I am supporting Hillary Clinton. I do feel that she is the best candidate. But I also have decided that I'm not going to criticize the other candidates. I don't want to, firing line in circles don't work for me. So I believe that Hillary Clinton is the best candidate for president. And as I look at all the issues out there that I mentioned and the difficulty of this presidency, I think we have to take that into consideration. And I do believe that even as a variety of Democrats have dropped out of their candidacy, that we really have had some terrific candidates on the Democratic side. I don't make judgments about the Republicans.
What, if you were to give advice to people who are trying to decide who to vote for, what would you say would be the critical questions that you think they ought to be looking at in terms of picking their presidential candidate?
Well, I think that some of that has to do with the kinds of things that I've said, which are, first of all, I think it is important to look at the issues. I think that I've only mentioned a few of the issues that are out there on national security. You raised some of the economic issues. We haven't talked about the domestic issues at all, which I am incompetent to talk about. But basically, in terms of issues to do with education and health and the gap between the rich and the poor in the United States, I think we need to look for somebody who has a full understanding of that panoply of issues and their interrelationship. So, and a desire to really dig deep into them. And so that's one part. The other part is something that I did say earlier, is this capability of dealing with a lot of diverse opinions. For me, that is one of the most important aspects of a president, is somebody who has the capability to listen and who likes to debate issues, who doesn't feel that he or she has all the answers. And so I would look for that. I there are any number of reasons I support Senator Clinton, but experience does make a huge difference. And while there are many things wrong with Washington, it's very hard to make the system work if you don't really know how Washington works. And so one can, in fact, work above it. And I can tell you this. I worked for two presidents who had come from as governors of states, and it took them both more than a year to figure out executive-legislative relations and how Washington worked. It's a crucial aspect of it. I was working for Senator Muskie when Jimmy Carter came in, and Senator Muskie was the chairman of committees and a Democrat, and it was very hard to figure out how to work, and President Clinton had a hard time getting priorities started. So I think that having Washington experience is not the worst thing for somebody who's actually going to try to make Washington work.
You just mentioned President Clinton. What do you see as the role of Bill Clinton if Hillary Clinton were elected? What would be the best use of Bill?
I think that there's, first of all, President Clinton is truly was a brilliant president, is a brilliant person who has done amazing things through the Clinton Global Initiative, of reaching out and working on issues to do with sustainable development and pandemic disease. And my sense is that those are the kinds of things that he would continue to do. There is a law, as a result of the fact of President Kennedy having named Bobby Kennedy as Attorney General, that you can't name a relative to a cabinet post. Nor can President Clinton be vice president because he can't be president again. So there are not official aspects to it. I think that it would be very smart to give him some job as an envoy. I had said earlier, actually, you know, if President Bush and his people had not practiced what they themselves said was their policy, ABC, anything but Clinton, they would have been very smart to name him as the envoy to the Middle East, to pick up where he had left off with Camp David. If he'd succeeded, everybody would have been happy. If he'd failed, it would have been his fault. So I think that there are a variety of positions for him, and I don't think that should be an issue in the campaign.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. I've got a number of questions that would like to look back into your years as Secretary of State, and perhaps you could give us your assessment of your biggest challenges and what you think were the biggest triumphs of your years.
Well, I'd like to, if I could kind of put the two terms together, and even though I was a UN ambassador, I was a member of the cabinet and the National Security Council system. I think the biggest mistake and the one that we all regret the most is not doing anything about Rwanda, although I can explain it. In terms of the context of the things that were going on at the time. We had lost forces in Somalia, if you remember. The helicopters had been shot down. They dragged Americans through the streets. We had trouble with our forces in terms of dealing with the refugees coming out of Haiti. We had troops in Bosnia. And there was a real question as to the extent to which the U.S. participated in peacekeeping operations. As I said earlier, that was one of the things that we were trying to figure out. I was sitting in the UN at the time. My instructions were not to support an expansion of the forces there. I got up and started yelling and screaming about my instructions, and ultimately I got them changed, but at the time they were very troublesome. And yet I can explain that by saying that what happened in Rwanda was what I would call volcanic genocide. The plane of the Rwandan president had been shot down. All of a sudden, there was all this killing. And I think even if we had been able, had supported getting more troops there, we couldn't have gotten them there on time. But I regret it, and President Clinton has talked about it a lot. I think the thing I'm proudest of is actually Kosovo, because it was not something that was on the was really something that was easy to accomplish within our own administration. The State Department has no forces, and so it was an issue of trying to persuade the Pentagon that it was the right use of force. It was then important to try to get Allied support for it. We knew that the Russians were going to veto anything in the UN, so we had to go through NATO. And so I did an awful lot of kind of hand-to-hand or telephone diplomacy to get Allied support. I invented something, which is probably a girl thing, which was the telephone conference call. I talked to our major allies every single day in order to get their support for the use of force and to work on what we were supposed to do. And then the war didn't start very well. The weather was bad, and then we bombed the Chinese embassy by mistake, and they started calling it Madeleine's War, but not as a compliment. Once we won it, it was called something else. But then just yesterday, I met somebody who was at an event that, for me, was one of the greatest events that I've ever participated in. The war was over, and I went to Pristina, the capital of Kosovo, and there were huge crowds there of people cheering with American flags and saying, thank you, America, and really feeling that we'd made a difference. And there is a whole generation of little girls in Kosovo whose first name is Madeleine. So I do think that was the best thing I did.
That's great. You know, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question. I've received a number of questions about your views on the American immigration policies and what that is going to do to foreign relations and affairs over the next 5 to 10 years.
I think it is one of the most difficult issues and one that is very difficult for me because I am an immigrant, a legal one, but I am an immigrant. And I am so grateful to this country for having been able to grow up a free American and then to actually be asked to represent America. There was nothing more thrilling than to sit behind a sign that says the United States. The earlier question that you asked about the integration of the global economy, I am thrilled we came here, but there are people, I believe, who actually would prefer to stay in the country where they were born because they can speak the language, they have a family support system, they are economic people who come here, not political. And therefore, what we have to do is work in order to get their economies to work so they don't have to come here. So that's one part of it. The other part, though, and this is very personal to me, and I know that it has connotations for other people, but as was mentioned, my father was a Czechoslovak diplomat, and we spent the war in London with the Czechoslovak government in exile. And the British were very nice. My father used to tell this story on a regular basis, and he'd say, the British would say, we're so sorry your country's been taken over by a terrible dictator. You're welcome here. What can we do to help you, and when are you going home? When we came to the United States in 1948, people would say, we're sorry that your country's been taken over by a terrible system. You're welcome here. What can we do to help you, and when will you become a citizen? And for me, that is what America is about, and I want us to be that country again in terms of welcoming those who feel that they can make a contribution to the United States. And so I find the immigration debate a very, very difficult one, and I hope that we can see the value of people who want to come here to really supply always the diversity that America represents to the rest of the world.
Thank you so much. And I'm just going to read one last question that came in. National presidential primary. I write in my choice, Madeleine Albright. So
thank you very much.
Our thanks. So I'm going to thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Mary Cranston, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.